principles is that we will practice democratic principles within our congregation and within our society at large. And the practice of democratic principles in a republic or any other type of institution or nation, you actually need space to practice those principles. You have to have space to do that. You have to have space for free assembly. You have to have space so that when you speak, your voice moves out and is heard. That requires space. You have to have space to go to institutions, to learn, to study, to read. You have to have space for the freedom of thought. You have to have space to engage in the interplay of ideas with one another. And when we feel that that space is being threatened or is shrinking, it is our obligation as Unitarian Universalists, having those principles, to address that. And this particular decision on Citizens United, many of us consider that a decision that will shrink the space for the practice of our democratic principles. And just briefly, one of the reasons for that is that in Supreme Court decision-making processes, that the decisions the Supreme Court make, they don't originate from the Supreme Court. Nothing really originates from the Supreme Court. They're to interpret the Constitution and apply it as they interpret the Constitution and the history of decisions that have gone previously in Supreme Courts. So precedent is a very important piece of the process of interpreting the Constitution and the life of our nation. Okay. So when a decision moves through a local court to a federal court to a Supreme Court, by its very definition, it has come from a local community. It has come from the people. It has come from the citizens' redress, or citizens saying, this law is not right. So it comes from the people. And so that's the key and central feature for all decisions in the Supreme Court process, is that it comes from the people, and so it's linked. It's linked to the people. In the Citizens United decision, the Supreme Court made the decision that we're going to broaden the case that was brought to us. What that meant was they disconnected the case. They disconnected the case that they were going to decide on. They disconnected their decision-making process from the people that brought the decision. And as a matter of fact, the people that brought the decision said, we want a very narrow scope on this particular agenda. We don't want a broad scope. We want it very narrow. As a nonprofit organization, they said, we want to keep it that way. And the Supreme Court said, no, we're going to make a decision that covers for-profit organizations, nonprofit organizations. We're going to make a decision that addresses a much larger case that was not brought to us. They disconnected it from the democratic process. They disconnected it from democratic principles. And that's clear in Justice Stevens' dissent. So I'm not making that up. It's clear, and others are saying the same thing, that this is one of the egregious natures of this particular decision. This isn't the first time a Supreme Court has done this. In 1803, the Supreme Court said, we have the final decision over legislation or executive decisions. So the Supreme Court made itself, in a sense, superior in the final decision-making process than the other two branches of government. Thomas Jefferson went crazy, but the Congress did not challenge that, so it stood today. When the Supreme Court says something, really, what do we do after that? Also, in 1819, there was a case that the New Republic emerging said that we want our universities to be public universities because we want to educate the whole population, because in order to have the kind of government we want to have, the people, the citizens of our government need to be well educated. That was the philosophy of the New Republic. Prior to the Revolution, there were private institutions that England had set up, that had chartered with King George, and these charters were basically for the purpose of training the nobility or educating the natives in Christianity or something along those lines. They weren't for educating the population to teach them to be citizens of a republic. That wasn't their nature. That wasn't what they were chartered for. So in 1819, the governor of New Hampshire and others in New Hampshire, the local community, said, we want to privatize, we want to public, make Dartmouth a public school and begin, you know, fulfill the dream of the republic. The Supreme Court honored the charter and the contract from King George with the board of directors of Dartmouth over the will of the people in New Hampshire, including the governor. That's another case where the local community in our republic was overruled by the Supreme Court. When I first read that, I couldn't believe it. I said, well, wasn't that what the Revolutionary War was about, so that we wouldn't be bound by the king? But when that long chain was connected and he said, let's put the chisel to it, somebody said, no, don't do it. I love that song. How many of us are sometimes in a prison or in hurtful or negative behavioral patterns and somebody says, hey, let me help you, and we say, no, I'm comfortable enough. I mean, that was a great song. And in 1886, a very similar thing, the Supreme Court said that corporations were persons, and that corporations have the rights of persons, and that corporations have the right to be defended by the Constitution and have constitutional rights, and literally declared this fictitious entity as equal as a person's rights. Really was the crux of the Citizens United decision, like the final straw. Corporations are persons, therefore they have rights to spend as much money as they want on elections, through campaigns, and through commercials. The danger of that is, if this corporation spends, as Stephen Colbert said, his corporation could spend $500 million on commercials for a particular... Where does my voice as an individual find space in that media process? Where's my space to practice my democratic principles if, with my money that I make and that what I commercials I can pay for? No, commercials that I cannot pay for. How do I get equal say? And so that's part of the concern, is that the democratic principles will not have a place to be practiced. So that's kind of a brief outline of the difficulties with the Citizens United. And then I thought, well, when we looked at Martin Luther King, we noticed that Martin Luther King, his dissertation was looking at a theologian named Paul Tillich and Henry Nelson Wyman, a Unitarian Universalist and a liberal Protestant theologian, Paul Tillich. And what he learned from Henry Nelson Wyman, among many things, but one of the main things that Henry Nelson Wyman did, is called the creative interchange, is that when we have dialogue as individuals, or we have dialogue as a community, or our church, say, would have dialogue with another church, or our Republican Party would have dialogue with our Democratic Party group, that would be great if we could organize that, to actually have dialogue. That in the space between the two entities in dialogue, in that space between that interchange, that creative interchange, something new could happen. We just wouldn't come to the conversation and repeat the same old stuff, repeat the formulas. We would actually come for an interchange of ideas, and we would listen, and we'd say, well, maybe I'm not quite right there. Maybe, I didn't know that piece of information. Maybe I need to go think about that and come back. That book you're talking about is really good, and I had this idea, but this is a different presentation. Maybe I need to go read that and come back for the conversation. But something new would happen. I would be different. I would not be the same. There isn't a rigidity in my thinking process. I got to thinking about belief systems, especially from the theologian Paul Tillich, that he learned about it. And Paul Tillich, one of his main principles, that Martin Luther King no doubt internalized in his work, was that there's an unconditionedness about existence. That in our world, we're conditioned to be here. We play roles, we play scripts, we put on many different selves, we put on different hats that Timothy Barrett's going to talk about and how to manage those. But there is a place where we're not conditioned at all. There are no hats. There are no beliefs. This was one of Paul Tillich's points that he was trying to make. So we have the creative interchange, and we have this particular aspect of that theologian Tillich's work, is that somewhere that we can, in our meditative life, in our prayerful life, we can keep backing up and keep backing up. We can let beliefs go. We can let thoughts go. We can let things go in our imagination. And we can find a spot where we can just breathe. And we are free. So there's an unconditioned aspect to this process. Another thing that he learned from Tillich, from Paul Tillich, is this concept that, and you all know and have heard about demons, about demons before demon possession, it's getting more popular. You know, as cultures get tighter or more controlled or less free, maybe, there's a direct correlation with the rise in people experiencing the demonic. However you understand that, that part's true. But what Paul Tillich did as a theologian, brought a theological perspective to bear, he said, no, demonology and that kind of stuff's not about individual people. It's about social structures. That social structures can be demonic. And when you look at the life of Martin Luther King, at first his movement toward liberation of African Americans and equal place and social equality. But as you look at his life, he begins to attack the war in Vietnam. He begins to attack the military-industrial complex, if you will. He begins to attack the profit-making institutions of the war in Vietnam. He begins to attack the very structures of our society, saying we need a revolution in our country to redistribute the income in our country so that there's more social equality. Well, you can imagine when that fell. I mean, the one thing to cry for rights, and maybe even though it was uncomfortable for many and appalling to many, but now to begin to mess with the money of our nation, he was pointing to that toward the end of his life. So here he is. He's got Wyman in him about this social and this creative interchange. He's got Tillich in him, knowing this mystical position of the unconditioned, and he's got this also this awareness that there's demonic structures. And I just want to say that I can understand why churches and ministers really don't pay attention to this concept of demonic structures. I can understand. Because I've been reading about it and trying to grasp what that might mean, and it is depressing. It cannot in any way, shape, or form be a popular subject. It's not going to get people to come down the aisle, I'll tell you. And where it led me was that in demonic structures, you will move toward genocide, you will move toward slavery, and we will need to talk about the Holocaust. And we will need to talk about social institutions that seek profit at the expense of what it means to be human, and even human existence. If we talk about the Jewish Holocaust in Germany before Nazism took hold in Germany, there was a pride in this welfare state that they were developing in the 1890s and early 1900s. But as that got more costly, there was conversation about, and again, we're going to talk demonic structures, there was conversation about selective killing of disabled people, of people who were troublemakers, of people who were this or that or that, people who didn't fit to contribute. The incurable was the word that was used. So that the money we would spend on the incurable would be freed up to spend on the curable. Now that's demonic. from my head. It doesn't get more evil than that. So if Martin Luther King's studying Paul Tillich, he's studying this. And so then I looked up Holocaust and genocide, and I started looking at the lists since 1490. And there are pages of genocide and Holocaust. Before the Jewish Holocaust, the historians called the Armenian Holocaust, they used the word Holocaust for other things. Lists. Then I noticed something else about these genocides and these Holocausts. They were connected with a particular economic system and economic advancement. While Holocaust or genocide was happening over here, people were doing exceedingly well over here. I grew up with a sense of pride and a chest that was full of oxygen when I thought about manifest destiny of our nation. Many of us were great thing, this manifest destiny. It was our destiny. But there's a genocide in the shadow side of that manifest destiny. There's genocide there. And over here, there's a people. We're great. And over here, there's a people being wiped out of existence. So economic systems are demonic. Can be demonic. We are called as a church, and this is where redemption comes in. At least one place redemption comes in. Redemption's just about, not about individuals and thinking you're saved or not saved. And in a way, that's easy, that conversation. And we hear a lot of that conversation throughout our nation. That's kind of easy, because I really don't have to change or do anything. Not really. I'm saved, I'm not saved. Come. Well, redemption, about redeeming demonic structures, now that's hard work. That's difficult work. We have a structure that's making lots of profit, but there are a lot of people dying over here to say, wait a minute, that's wrong. Try to get the legislation to change that structure. In this day and age, good luck. And then I began to look at advancement of imperialistic nations and genocide, holocausts, slavery are just part and parcel. They go with it. And I'm thinking, one time I was listening to the socialist candidate running for president here in Melbourne a few years ago, and all he did was anti-capitalism. And I said to myself, you will not win one person in this crowd with that conversation. That's just not going to happen here. And socially, you could talk about universal health care. You could talk about better educational systems. You could talk about good things. Or you could talk about Eugene Debs and how Franklin Delano Roosevelt co-opted socialistic policies into our nation to stabilize the economy. You could talk about a lot of things. So with that warning in my own head, are these things, these genocides, these oppressions of people, this enslavement of people, is that part of capitalism? That's the question. Because certainly I have lived well in this society. Periodically, as I'm complaining about something, my father will say, yeah, there's 10 people around this table. Looks like we're all eating pretty good. Nobody's coming over the fences to get us. So, you know, we've all got a pretty good life here. This is what you do in your life. And you'll go around the table. And he said, we're all doing pretty good. What are you talking about? That's reality, too. That's reasonable, too. And so, in our space of being able to practice our democratic principles, I think that's what we get. sitting around the table, talking and moving in a direction that's good for all of us. That's where we get. Is that space shrinking where families can have that experience? Because the democratic principles are shrinking. Does our economic system itself shrink that space when it is the primary decision maker in our culture? So I go out on a limb with this thinking and bring a theological perspective that I think I can justify, but it's a theological perspective. In theology, people get confused a bit about theology, and as I read theology, you think the study of God. The theology is really not about the study of God. Theology is the study about things that people have written about their thoughts about their understanding of God. I mean, that's what theology is. It can't be. And then, say if I do have an experience with God, and I want to communicate it, well then, that experience, say that was an experience with God, as soon as I communicate it, now I've got a language that I'm using to communicate it, so it's my interpretation of that experience. So theology is really about working with people, their best understanding of who we are as human beings, and what we want to try to do in life, our ultimate concerns, and our ultimate values. So when we bring a theological perspective on something, there is an assumption that we are trying to unify people in a good way, that we are trying to promote a community of kindness, that we are trying to move in the direction of a community of love where people are cared for. So when we bring a theological perspective, that's what we're trying to do. So when I say from a theological perspective, I think this Citizens United decision, as far as I can tell, will foster demonic structures. That's a theologian speaking. Somebody else might say something else about it. But when you have a decision that creates a law in the land that shrinks the people's voices, and elevates economic structures, elevates those voices. And when we look at history, and when we look at these genocides, and these holocausts, and enslavement, that have been, and they're connected by an economic system that's oppressive, when the economic system leads the nation, I don't know what else to conclude. What else do we conclude when we are no longer able to govern ourselves, when somebody else will govern us without our say? A brief example of how this works that's very subtle. Because we think, you know, and I'm not like the founding era, the thinking of the founding fathers of our nation. They weren't against business, but they were against monopolies and such. So we're not against business, we're not necessarily against corporation, but we are against corporations governing our nation and the demonic aspects of that. So, for example, this company's out of existence, sorry. Continental King started a company. There was a union. One of the laws of the company was that in 20 years, you will have this retirement and this health care afterwards. Forevermore. Okay. So, the company, and this is factual, the company hired some computer guys to come up with a program to find out when they would have to end the company so they wouldn't have to pay the pension. So, 19.8 years, 19.6 years, whatever that was, for the most people, was there. So, nobody knew that these computer guys created the program to figure that out. Because how could you do that? You could say, this looks like a coincidence, this looks like a connection. Nah, this isn't right. How could you prove that? So the union challenged that. The company sent 100,000 pieces of paper and boxes and all that, thinking it would overwhelm the people looking at it. And they left the computer program within those papers, and they found that they went to court and they won. Well, here's people in good faith saying, yes, I will work here, and I will make a contract with you for 20 years. I will do that. And in return, this is what I'll get. That's a contract. Now, they have an ERISA law. That's what they got on in 1947, that companies cannot interfere or disrupt persons' pensions. So they have laid stand on. And so they had to pay the pensions, and it actually put them out of business. That's also demonic. Without legislation to defend the democratic principles and whatever social equality among ourselves that we can muster, without that in place, without the people saying, no, it's not okay for you to do that, without a place for our voice to go to find space, to engage in dialogue, to create the legislation that protects those people that are in that contract, we're in trouble. And that was just an accident. You think of anything to go on, we don't have no clue about. So as Unitarian Universalists, many of us have good space, good life. And many of us have free time. Many of us have resources. So you go, what's this guy talking about? My life's pretty good. What, you know? If what I'm saying has truth and that space is shrinking, who are we as Unitarian Universalists? Who are we if we step into the history and the heritage of Unitarian Universalism? Who are we, and are we being called upon to stand and begin to push back and say, that's not okay. That needs to be different. And I think we are being called upon to push back, to speak, to address these issues. We are being called upon to do that.